the foundation was poured and it was 12 inches out of square. And the framers just went in and they built the house to the specified dimension, and there was one corner of the garage hanging 12 inches out into space. So working for the concrete company that did that, we had to jack those walls up, saw cut out the corner of that of where it was out of square, drill and dowel and pour back to get the foundation underneath the walls that the framers just put. The framers didn't follow. Thankfully, they didn't follow the foundation. They built it to the dimension and just let it hang out there, knowing it was going to have to be fixed.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. We are kind of winding back the clock this episode. We're going to be talking about the stem walls, which happened a couple months ago, but we're kind of on the tail end of the framing, just to put the context for you if you're listening to this as it's happening. And so we're going to try to get caught back up and go through each of the processes, discuss some of the common questions and some of the things that might not have made the cut to our final video. And today, the topic at hand is our block stem walls. The most common question by far, and in fact, often it wasn't even a question, almost more of an assertion, why are you not using concrete, you idiot? Things kind of like that. And we made a whole video discussing that, but it still seems like there's more to say on it. So looking back, Dad, at this point, would you do it different? Would you do concrete looking back, or do you still think going the block was the right choice?
There's not a chance I would have gone with concrete on that. A couple of reasons that we sort of already talked about in that video. But number one, I was tired of carrying concrete forms around. There's an element of tedium in mobilizing the forms and then stripping the forms and cleaning them up and restacking them, and it didn't sound fun. But the big thing was the appearance, that I loved the way that split face block looks, and I knew that it was going to be a big part of driving up and seeing the house from the bottom, and it needed to kind of blend with the riprap that we have stacked on the slope. And I, mm-hmm. you know, form liners on the concrete, yes. Acid stain the concrete, yes. But that was just more effort and more time, and it just didn't make sense, I didn't think, and I still don't. I think it's good.
Even when I think back, it sounds so easy. Why not just set some forms and fill it full of concrete? It just really sounds like it's not a big deal, but it just is. And after seeing both of them completely now, man, concrete seems like quite a bit more work. And maybe it is. And I know it's probably also, you can get things stronger, so maybe it's also better, but it just really seems like a ton more work to do that with forms.
So there's a line item when you're estimating any job, but especially concrete, about mobilizing and demobilizing. Concrete takes a lot of mobilization. Those forms, they have to be stored, and they have to be clean, and they have to be oiled, and they have to be ready for the next job. Mm-hmm. And so you have to pull them out from wherever they are and get them to the site and spread them out and do the work and then clean them. It's almost a toothbrush. I mean, the forms that I rented from Bruce Caldwell, I cleaned them up almost with a toothbrush because they were perfect when I got them. They had to be perfect when they went back. Mm-hmm. And the plywood forms that I own are the same way. It just takes so long to mobilize and demobilize concrete that it is a cost, an effort that you have to take into. I have to take into account at 61. I didn't used to notice it.
What about just forming it with plywood like you have done before? I haven't seen that up close, but that's certainly lighter weight. Is it a lot slower than using those Simon forms?
It is. Snap ties. So if you use 3/4-inch form panels, you have snap ties on much closer centers. If you use 1 1/8 form panels, which are so heavy to carry around, you can spread out the spacing and sometimes just use a spreader cleat at the top and the bottom without any intermediate ties. Mm-hmm. But it's slower. And the fact that our stem wall was going to be so tall on, you know, 2/3 of it, 48 inches tall or so, would have needed a lot of hardware to keep the form panels parallel and uniform, mm-hmm. and to stand the load. Lots of work, lots of time.
We got a lot of comments and questions about the quality of the work, and people kind of looking at it and saying, I don't know about that. And at the time, we were even, no job, nothing generally goes exactly the way as planned. And in some parts of this job, it wasn't as planned. What can you speak to about the block itself and how it was laid. Obviously, Mike and Steve did a great job. And as I asked before we started, if you could go back, you wouldn't change a thing. But I'm sure in stem walls, nothing's perfect. How does this one stack up in that regard to other block stem walls?
So the mason that I've used for the 24 years I've been here until this job with Mike and Steve was Gary and Lloyd, two guys working together. They had matching trucks, and they just worked two of them. Sometimes they would have a hod, and their niche was perfect, just perfect and decorative. And I've used them a lot. And I think I mentioned that Gary was online to do it, but then he had shoulder surgery and couldn't. And so I was in a bind to keep this the house moving forward during the summer months. I had to get it done. And I can't emphasize enough how much I appreciate the Siegels adjusting their schedule to come and do it. So that's item one. Item two is, it was a fair price. They charged us a fair price. And so item number three, I can swallow hard and say, yeah, wasn't perfect, but it was darn sure good. So good enough has a bad, there are negative connotations about saying good enough. It's better than good enough. The house is on it. It fit. I was able to deal with any discrepancies and up and down or side to side. And so how do you complain about that, you know? It's in place.
You know, as a carpenter and doing carpentry, how often would you approach a house to frame, whether it was slab or stem wall, that was perfect? Or certainly, it seemed to me like this would have fallen within the range of sort of typical, you know? I doubt there's very many carpentry jobs where the carpenter shows up and is not complaining about some high spot or low spot. They're going to see it all, and it seems like there's always going to be something. Is that right or not really?
Yeah. That foundation would have warranted no more objection than any other, you know, almost any other foundation. Now, occasionally you would come to one that was just right, but more often you would come to one that was so far out that you really had to accommodate your program and swallow hard and, you know, live with some projections or some, you know, the plates running over. That is a very standard thing to encounter, particularly in a tract house situation. So there's a story. I was part of in Las Vegas one time. Yeah. The foundation was poured and it was 12 inches out of square. And the framers just went in and they built the house to the specified dimension, and there was one corner of the garage hanging 12 inches out into space. So working for the concrete company that did that, we had to jack those walls up, saw cut out the corner of that of where it was out of square, drill and dowel and pour back to get the foundation underneath the walls that the framers didn't follow. Thankfully, they didn't follow the foundation. They built it to the dimension and just let it hang out there, knowing it was going to have to be fixed. So that was off the scale on the shipwreck side, you know.
But a mistake like that, it wasn't as easy for the framers as simply build it out here. They probably had to, or did it. I guess they could just hang that board out the end and pretend there was concrete under it and just kind of march right ahead.
That's what they did, because they were there by the piece. They didn't have time to be fooling around. Wow. And their agreement presupposed a slab that was close enough to work on. So I'm sure that it came to a stop and they got the superintendent over there and he said, well, just build it and we'll make the concrete company come back and fix underneath your work. So with that in mind, I thought the Siegel boys did just a fine job, and I will never be done being grateful to them for getting there so fast and getting it done and keeping us on schedule.
In remodeling, let's say, or working in old houses, it's common to come into a wall that's not flat or a windowsill that's, you know, got a crown in it. Do those always basically trickle through to the foundation, or is that just as often a framing mistake that's kind of showing up, or is it, you know, we're not really into the framing yet in our videos, but do all of the discrepancies in most homes kind of come down to a bad foundation that just that one mistake or whichever one gets projected through the whole building?
No, not all of them. Once you're coming up off the foundation, whether or not you're going to build it plumb is up to you. And so it's easy. And in fact, not unexpected, particularly in old houses, to find that the house just wasn't quite nailed together plumb. Or, getting back to your assertion about the foundation, that the soil wasn't prepared and a corner has settled a long ways, so the foundation may have been put in fine, but the ground just gave way and now it's, you know, it's racked or it's racking or it's broken. But blame is, you can spread blame everywhere throughout all the crafts for big problems. But let me say this, I grew up sort of idolizing old-time carpenters as being craftsmen without peer, and everything they did being, you know, that the old-timers, boy, they really got it. But you don't have to remodel very many houses built from 1890 to 1950 before you realize, wow, there were hacks and butchers and pros in that period of time too, and every job could allow a different attention to detail.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get behind the facade, as soon as you get behind the surface, you can see that when they were cutting with a handsaw and chopping corners off with an axe and, you know, putting the lath and plaster up and chopping the lath with the back of their lathing hatchet, man, if it was behind the finish, all that mattered was that it was in place and that the actual joinery failed into insignificant, faded into insignificance because the joinery was so hard with hand power. So they cut every corner. For instance, a ceiling joist or a collar tie, you know, on top of the plates with the rafters coming down alongside the ceiling joist, very often the top corner of that ceiling joist is chopped off, not cut with a handsaw, but they would nail it together, let the top corner run wild, and then come back with a sharp axe and chop that corner off. But the house is sitting there square, plumb, and true, but there are chop marks inside of there where it was the quickest, most labor-efficient way to get the work done.
Because it's faster than using a handsaw.
Yes, faster than using a handsaw.
Which, even when I think about it, I think I could probably get through with a handsaw faster, but I guess a sharp axe.
Oh, a sharp axe. Yeah. A sharp axe, man. I mean, you get a lot of work
done. Wow. That's really interesting. Is it, you know, to that point, there's also the owner themselves who might, if their builder comes to them and say, this is the situation, what do you want me to do? It could very well be that the owner didn't want to pay the price to fix it. And they said, am I going to see it? And they said, well, only when you stand here and look at it this way.
Right.
And then in which case a lot of owners, probably me included, would just say, well, just move ahead. I'd rather not pay you an extra day's work to correct something that, you know, so it's a value judgment for pretty much everybody along the way.
It is. Yeah.
Is it generally in building, we're kind of away from stem walls, but it's because framing is what's looming. Is it generally understood that the framers fix whatever the, you know, let's say like a discrepancy like ours, let's just call it average for the sake of the conversation. Is it generally understood in the trades that the carpenter brings everything back to perfectly square, plumb, and true, regardless of what they started with? It's sort of their job to accommodate all of that?
So, of course, that depends on who you're talking to, who the person is doing it, and what their moral compass is. But the answer to your question is yes. The previous craft is gone, and the responsibility to do it right rests with whoever's standing there working right now. Now, if it's way out of specifications, that guy may put the brakes on and say, "Wait, this is not standard practice and procedure. This is not workmanlike manner, and so it's going to require, you know, I need some more money to heal up what the previous guy did or didn't do." And on the other end of the spectrum, it's always just a bonus when you come on a foundation that's perfect, and it does happen once in a while. But ordinarily, the framer just has to anticipate, I'm going to have to shim a little, I'm going to have to shorten a little, I'm going to have to sort of fudge the lines on top of the foundation just a little bit to get it where I'm comfortable moving forward with the project.
One of the things that I really liked about Mike and Steve as I learned it is that masonry, especially for Mike, I guess, is kind of a second or third craft. They are builders and framers primarily who picked up masonry as a bonus and as an added tool, which I thought was kind of unusual just because masonry is such a, there's just so much skill like that you have to earn to do that. It's not quite like you can just, you know, like picking up a power drill and like I can drill that the same as anybody.
Yeah.
And they have, so given that they are not, you know, born and raised masons, third generation, the fact that they were able to knock that out in 3 days was really cool. I thought that it's just kind of like a little bonus skill they had in addition to being all around builders.
I've got nothing but respect for those guys, If Gary would have done it, yeah, I would have had less work to make the house conform to the foundation. But man, I just appreciate what they did for us.
Mike and Steve have another brother. What was his name?
Joe.
Joe, who was not a part of the stem wall job, who stopped by a few days later. I was just working through the footage and have some shots of him coming onto the job. Joe is a concrete guy who recently or is in the process of bringing an invention, a knee board adaptation to market. And we'll talk about that, I think, on the main channel and showcase it once it's done. But I got to think that that is relatively common among tradesmen to be thinking of inventions to their trade mm-hmm. that could take off and maybe make their life a little easier if they make mm-hmm. a few bucks. Mm-hmm. And they mm-hmm. certainly are the ones who would know. Do you find that's the case? Are guys kind of constantly talking about tools that they think would be better?
You know, it's kind of interesting. A certain segment of the construction population that I'm familiar with don't spend their time thinking about too much besides a six-pack and the football game and getting to the end of the day. Mm. And then a certain segment do exactly what you're thinking of. While they're working, they're thinking, man, I could do this better. What would it take to do this better? Why hasn't somebody thought of... And then, you know, it's hard to get past that point. But some... And the guys that aren't thinking about that are thinking about, how am I going to get the education I need, and mostly around pricing, mm-hmm. the pricing for the work that we're doing so that I can step out on my own. How am I going to learn what this work is really worth so as soon as I step out, I'll be able to charge fair market value? So there's at least those three. Oh, and then there's the other set that's just so irresponsible. If they're there, they're there, and if they're not, they're not, and they're just drinking up everything they make. So there's three or four broad general categories of people, but one of them is certainly the ones that are looking to innovate and invent and streamline the processes that they do every day.
I got to think, among business owners, this would be among like big subcontractors who have employees, that information of how much they're charging their client is kind of a valuable commodity. And I got to think they might not make that public to all their employees. Probably not a good idea, right?
Yeah, I think it's kind of closely guarded if you can. And there are ways to kind of ferret it out. But one kind of, so if any of you are watching this and are thinking, I'd really like to be doing this on my own, kind of a rule of thumb that seems to make sense to me, and I don't have any idea if this is true or not, it's just what I think. It's whatever you're making by the hour, you probably think you're a little underpaid. So if you were making what you really thought your job was worth, okay, probably twice that number is the number that you would be billing yourself out at if you were working by the hour as a licensed subcontractor or contractor. Twice what you're thinking of in terms of what your time is worth is probably what your time is worth in the context of the business. In order to have a business that's viable and you're able to pay some overhead and have some profit and buy some tools and keep your truck running and pay your license and your bond. So the real number is going to be way higher than you're thinking it is if you intend to be viable over time.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to kind of work through each of our episodes in this manner. So if you have specific questions about specific parts of this house, let us know, and we'll try to spend some time answering those in this format, which gives us a lot more flexibility. You know, when we're going through these videos the first time, it's not easy to know exactly what all might be slipping through the cracks. And in fact, in some cases, like in the case of the plumbing video, a bunch of footage actually slipped through the crack. I do know how it happened. We'll talk about it later, but point is there's still more to be said, and we'll try to do it in this manner. So thank you, everybody, for listening.